All right, well, good morning or good afternoon, everyone. I want to welcome you to our ITIF Kauffman Foundation event to release the 2010 State New Economy Index. And I'm Rob Atkinson, the president of ITIF, and we first of all want to thank the Kauffman Foundation, which, for those of you who don't know, is a foundation in Kansas City, which was founded by an entrepreneur and is dedicated and been devoted to supporting research and advocacy and outreach on entrepreneurship and entrepreneurship policy. So they have generously funded our work now for 3 years at the 2007 index, 2008, and now 2010. And also, it's not a coincidence that we're releasing a report today. It's Global Entrepreneurship Week today, which is a enterprise that Kauffman launched, and it's a great success really all around the world to impress upon everyone, including policymakers, importance of entrepreneurship. So what I'm going to do is just really give you some of the highlights of the report, some of the interesting findings this year, talk a little bit about policy. Bob's going to talk 10, 12 minutes as well, and then we'll just open up and have a discussion. Let me start by introducing Bob. He is the Vice President of Research and Policy at the Kauffman Foundation, where he oversees the foundation's extensive program on data collection and research. So if you really want to find the best research today on entrepreneurship and its relation to economic growth, I encourage you to go and look at the Kauffman website. They have really done great work there and supported top-notch researchers really all around the country on this. He's also the author of a recent book, Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism, and the Economics of Growth and Prosperity, which he authored with William Bobble, a leading economist at Columbia. And that's a Yale Press book from 2007. And it's been translated into 10 languages. That's pretty impressive. And before that, he was a senior fellow at the Economic Studies Program at Brookings, where he directed previously was vice president and director of the Economic Studies Program, co-authored more than 20 books, edited another 14, co-authored or written over 200 articles on a wide variety of issues. So really, Bob's one of the leading economists in the country, if not the world, on many of these issues around growth and entrepreneurship. So I'm really happy to have him. I'm not going to read the rest of it, so really, I could pass it around if you want to read it or you can look at it. So what are we doing here? Back a long, long time ago, before ITIF was in existence, I had a series that we did called the State New Economy Index. And the idea was that there was this strange thing called the new economy, and it was useful to look at it. And I have to say, a lot of people now say, well, why do you stick to the title? Well, it's kind of like, just because, why doesn't Google change their name to something else? Because it's a brand. But more seriously, I do think that, people say, oh, the new economy is not real. The new economy is real, just it's sort of become the real economy, so it's not as new anymore. But when we talk about the new economy, we mean an economy that is much more knowledge-based, more global, more entrepreneurship, more entrepreneurial and dynamic, more technology-driven, and more IT-driven. And that really, I think, does describe the evolution of the U.S. economy and many economies around the world. So the real important question is, if you are a state, how well is your state positioned to take advantage of these new realities? So we have done this report now. This is the fifth one. Started in 99, 02, 07, 08, and 10. And the goal really is to look at these indicators at the state level. And they're organized into five different groups. The other thing I would add, this isn't a study that looks at state economic performance. So we talk a little bit about that, but we're not evaluating states on how fast they're growing or not. It's not a report on state economic policy, so we're not measuring state unemployment insurance taxes or how well they're doing on various education measures. This is an attempt to look at state economic structure and how well a state is or is not structured to take advantage of these new success factors. So overall scores. Let me actually back up and say all of these indicators, there's 26 of them, they're using the most recent data that are available, and they're all divided by a denominator of gross state product, the number of adult workers, or some measure to control for the size of states. Now, overall scores, what we do is we take the 26 variables, we take standard deviations of all 26, add those standard deviations up. Then you have a range of scores. We divide those into four equal clumps, if you will. So if your score is range from 30 to 90, then that's a range of 60. So there's quadrants of 15, if you will, and there are 15 units, if you will. So we're sort of doing this in the top quartile, not the top quarter of states, but the top quartile of scores, or the middle quartile. And what you didn't have here is, because we're still early on, but you don't have the legend. So the legend really here is, when you see these slides, the dark green is the top quartile, so they're the highest scores. The middle green, light green, is the second highest quartile. The light blue is the third highest quartile, or second lowest. And the gray, the dark gray, is the lowest quartile stage. Now, the first thing that pops out when you look at that map is the map guy made a mistake, because there's only one state that's dark green, and that's Massachusetts. And what's interesting about this report is that every year we've done this report, Massachusetts has been number one. And every year we do the report, they keep going up. The gap between Massachusetts and everybody else gets getting bigger. But this is the first time the gap has gotten so big that they're in a league by themselves. They're number one, and the closest state next to them is Washington. And there's a lot of reasons for that. When you look at some of the variables, they're number one in venture capital disbursement. They're number one on knowledge workers. Workforce education. But workforce education is a variable that looks at how well educated the workforce is. They're number one in the country on fast growing firms. So you guys say, well, Massachusetts is kind of old, industrial, kind of backward state. When you look at Massachusetts, what they've been able to do is Massachusetts seems to be caught up in this cycle of cumulative causation, where they attract lots and lots of smart young people to come there to go to college, whether it's MIT or Harvard or BU or BC or the many other colleges, Tufts, et cetera, up there. They then get out, and many of them actually start companies. And then those companies grow, and they expand in more people. They draw more people in, and they have venture capital there. And they're able to essentially have this very nice cycle that keeps working for them. And not to say that Massachusetts economy is perfect, but they really are in the lead. Now, if you look at the other places that do well here, you see Washington, Oregon, California, East Coast sort of dynamic here, Virginia up into New Hampshire is a new economy corridor. And then a little bit in the west, in the Midwest with Illinois and Minnesota. But the other thing you see is really this bi-coastal or bifurcated economy. Now, we haven't done this, which we'll probably do it now, but we did, at one time, we've done some comparisons between electoral college results and new economy scores. Not at all to make this into a partisan issue, but it is interesting. And there is a positive correlation between getting a D vote and being high on the new economy, and an R vote and being low on the new economy. New economy states tend to go more likely to become Democratic in their politics. It's not 100% correlation, but it's an interesting correlation. So what you see is really a couple of things. One, you see that deep pocket of brown. What's that all about? That's really about, obviously, the Deep South having a long, long legacy of figuring out how to build their economy around essentially low wages, low levels of education, and recruiting low-skill branch plant jobs from the north. I mean, they did that very successfully for over 50 years. That broke down in the 90s, started to fail. Those companies weren't going to be recruited to North Carolina. They were going to be recruited to Mexico or China or whatever. So the South invested in a strategy that really fundamentally set them up into a position that isn't sustainable. And their challenge, and certainly many of the governors, if not all of them, understand this challenge, and they're trying to move out of that and become more entrepreneurial, more technology-driven, more knowledge-driven. The other place you see that is the Upper Plains states, where you see South Dakota, Wyoming. And again, that's the legacy of those states really being natural resource states. Your farming, mining, extraction economies that historically were not knowledge-driven, entrepreneurial. So it suggests that each of these states really has different challenges and different opportunities. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go just run through some of the indicators, you know, pretty quickly, not all of them. A few years ago, actually in 99, when we did the first study, it turns out that Michigan didn't rank very well. And the head of the Michigan Economic Development Department, in sort of always a good thing to do, rather than look internally and see what's the matter with what you're doing, you much easier to blame other people. So that they blamed us and said, you know, our numbers are completely wrong. There's all these IT workers in GM and Ford, and you're not measuring them when you're looking, because we had a measure at the very first study, which we still have on, called high-tech jobs. And he said, you're not going to capture that because autos is not listed as a high-tech job in the way the NAICS codes are. So software would be, for example, or pharmaceuticals or things like that. So I said, okay, valid point. So we went and measured them the next time on IT jobs, and Michigan was also ranked abysmal on that as well. So it had no effect. But now we've continued to keep that in there because it's a good indicator. What it is these are IT jobs that are not in the IT industry. So these would be programmers and software and network managers in banks and hospitals and retail firms, et cetera, et cetera. This is important because those jobs have grown 4 times faster than all other jobs in the economy in the last decade. And what you see, again, similar dynamics, but somewhat different. So Missouri is doing well there. Texas, North Carolina.
I'm glad to know that Missouri's doing well in something.
Each state, there's a few of these things. Almost every state has something that's a positive. Managerial, technical, and professional jobs. These are jobs that are high-wage jobs. They're growing faster than other jobs in the economy. Other jobs have declined. These have grown. Again, similar dynamic. You can see that. You see states like Illinois and Michigan doing well. Corporate headquarters jobs in particular, and that drives some of it. This is an interesting one, which is the average education level of immigrants to the country, foreign immigrants, obviously. And what you see there, so we take that and we give you a score for your high school and another score for your college, higher, et cetera, et cetera. So we kind of assess the average education level. What you see is the southern border states, Texas, Arizona, some way, maybe this explains the Arizona vote in a lot of ways, certainly influences the Arizona vote. California actually ranks low as well. Now compare that to Montana and North Dakota, who are getting all those illegal Canadians crossing over the border.
Kansas and Missouri.
Ohio is another state, very high level. And maybe there's a guy up there, there's a guy in Ohio who's pushed, a guy named Richard Herman, who is.
Yes.
Pushed entrepreneur. Foreign immigration is a source of renewal for Ohio because you get high-tech knowledge-based entrepreneurs coming from other countries. They start companies, and Kaufman has done a lot of the best work on that. So you can see that, interestingly, how different states do on that. Now, you go back and look at, this is migration of U.S. knowledge workers. So these are U.S. workers who move from one state to the next. So you go back here, immigration. Now you go here, and you have a little bit different pattern. What this essentially says is that people who don't have a lot of education move to Arkansas. That's technically what it says. I'm being a flicker. But it does suggest, think about that, though Arkansas is the only state in the bottom here. And I think Arkansas is, that's the only one. Essentially, the immigrants, the in-migrants from other states to Arkansas have relatively low number of years of schooling relative to a state like Massachusetts or New Hampshire, Vermont. Vermont's quite interesting, where there are, you know, folks who are, you know, having, I don't know what we call them, you know, yuppies who want to live the good life, and they're deciding they're going to go up there, and they have college degrees, graduate degrees, and end up starting companies and starting jobs. Like Vermont's actually high on entrepreneurship too, which is an innovative-related factor. It's a measure we put in a few years ago, partly because we didn't want this index to be just about high-tech jobs and Silicon Valley and the like. We think that the new economy is just as much about doing manufacturing in new ways, in more productive, more knowledge-based ways. Very bad measures of manufacturing that are out there. This is the best one we get to, which was manufacturing value add. I would add, by the way, one of the things we do on this, I don't think anybody else does, is we control on three variables patents, exports, and manufacturing value added. We control for industrial mix. So in other words, if you look at average value added, it varies dramatically by type of sector. So if you're in the tobacco industry, you have incredibly high value added per worker. If you want to do a great tour, do the Philip Morris plant down here in Richmond. If you drive by, do a tour of the factory. Very cool. I mean, they might have a couple of workers in there. I didn't see any. It's a completely, really automated factory with high-tech equipment. So you don't want to bias these numbers by saying, well, if you've got a lot of tobacco firms and pharmaceutical industry. So we've controlled for that. Through a statistical way, we control and make sure every state's equal, and then say, given your firms, how well are your firms doing on being high-value added? And they're, as far as I know, I can't really identify a pattern here. I don't know why things are high, why things are low, but at least it's interesting. It tells state policymakers some interesting data about what they might be looking at. Washington, Arizona, Connecticut being quite high. Another one is high wage traded services. The idea here that a lot of states still think that the only way to grow their economy is manufacturing. And manufacturing is important, but because it brings money in from outside, but so do what are called traded services. So the janitorial service that cleans this building, they're not a traded service. They get their money all from the local economy. But ITIF is a traded service. We import money from Kansas City and grow the Washington economy because we're taking money from Kansas City. International law firms, international consulting firms, insurance, certainly some banking. So we looked at what sectors are services are traded, and we looked at them by wage level, and we picked the highest wage services as the most important. And again, New York, perhaps not a big surprise there. Publishing, financial services, all of these kinds of sectors there. The export focus of manufacturing and services. This is an interesting one because first of all, have some data challenges with export because, is the export really coming from where it is, or is it coming from the port? And, I think the federal government really needs to do a lot better job, but we do the best we can with the data. But Texas, for some reason, is doing very, very well there. FDI, again, sort of a measure of how linked in the state is to the global economy. What you see here and what you've seen for a decade is that the Asians don't do a lot of FDI, really. This is a reflection still of European and Canadian-dominated FDI coming into the country. And I think it's because the Europeans don't want to fly an extra 3 hours. That's a stick it here, and you got a shorter flight to Brussels or to Hamburg. But you can see a very East Coast phenomena. South Carolina does very well, New Jersey. Some of that's also the type of sectors that the Europeans are investing in, chemicals and others. Job churning, this is an interesting measure. This is a measure of the number of firms in a state that start up in a year and die in a year, starts and deaths, as a share of overall firms. And you could say, well, why would you want to include that? Wouldn't you just want to do firm birth? Turns out there's actually about a 0.5 positive correlation between firm death and job growth, overall net job growth in the state. So it's really counterintuitive. Firms are dying, yet you're growing jobs. That's actually a good research question as to why that's the case. But I think the hypothesis of people is that you want an economy that's dynamic. If your economy is not changing and not vibrant with lots of risk-taking, you're not going to do well. So part of this is about that factor. Part of it is just also states and regions that are going to grow faster because the population's growth are going to do well. Fast-growing firms. These are Inc. 500 and Fast 500. These are firms that essentially are what could be called gazelles that double in size in 4 years. Sort of the analogy here. And you can see very interesting. Massachusetts number one, but Maryland, Utah. So in there, what you're really finding is a bunch of largely technology-driven firms. A lot of those Fast 500 are, even if they're not software firms, many of them are enabled by IT and technology and using that to build new kinds of businesses and business models. Entrepreneurial activity. This is a data set that Kauffman funds a researcher, Rob Fairley. Where is Rob now? Santa Cruz, UC Santa Cruz. And Rob does a wonderful study every year using the using census CPS data and asks, which looks at how have you started a new company. And what you find is, and some of the companies are what we call fast growing, some are not, but it's a nice measure of trying to get at that. And again, you can see an interesting pattern here, but the West doing better, again, partly because of population growth. The other pattern is states like Montana, where some of that is entrepreneurship by necessity. You can't go down the block and get a big company job, so people are more likely to start. That Vermont used to be quite high for similar reasons.
Rob, is entrepreneurship defined as a startup, or is it being self-employed? Is it a small business? How do you define entrepreneurship?
I can give you the definition. It's somebody engaged in self-employed activity for at least 15 hours a week. And what fairly measures is the start of those. All right? So it's somebody who begins to do that, and then they tell the census taker that's what they're doing. So it includes both self-employed people and people who also are hiring people, and it's hard to distinguish on them.
Can it be eBay?
Huh?
Can it be eBay activity?
Yes, it can be eBay.
Someone could be counted three times.
You mean they could have three businesses?
Yeah.
No, because they're asking the individual.
I see.
The other thing I would just add on this is to get, in our view, to get a really good snapshot of this ecosystem of activity, there's really no one perfect indicator, so we kind of mesh them all together, if you will. And this tells you something, but it doesn't tell you other things. And it doesn't get at this distinctly fast growth and sort of mom-and-pop kinds of things. But it's a useful, I think, important indicator. Another related one is inventor patents. These essentially are patents filed by individuals, which, again, goes a little bit more to you're probably not going to file a patent if you're thinking of being self-employed only. But you think this is more related to growth business. Very interesting. For some reason, Utah, don't know why, but Utah has very high levels here, Oregon as well. Online population is interesting. Alaska always does very, very well, which is the same reason why Finland and Sweden do really, really well on online, because we have really not a lot else to do. It's cold as heck, and so you
they can watch our TV show, though.
They can watch a TV show.
Her TV show.
Oh, her TV show, exactly.
Yep.
I know.
Actually, they can be in her TV show.
Yeah. But again, you see, very effective. Interesting, though, look at the four states that are lowest in online population. States that historically have not had higher levels of education or other kinds of job. Broadband telecom, this is a measure of how many people are online as well as the speed of the network. One of the things you see here is, again, this pattern here, Vermont all the way up. That's probably the Verizon effect. Verizon, the only company that's deployed fiber to the home in much of their network, high speeds, has spurred cable to do it well. And so that's one. California, perhaps not a surprise there as well. Health IT, this is a measure, and health IT is an important measure. This is just a measure of prescriptions, so electronic prescription. Few states, Massachusetts being interesting because they had the best legislation early on of anybody, and they were able to dominate that. High-tech jobs, this is a measure of various sectors, software, hardware, biotech, pharmaceutical, et cetera. And that's, again, not a big surprise there. These are the states that we all think about. Perhaps Idaho is not, but Idaho actually has Micron and several other, what's the big software company there? The guys who used to make that for the, Eric Schmidt used to be the CEO there.
Yeah.
No,
that's Utah.
No, yeah.
Nobel.
Nobel.
Nobel was Utah.
Yeah, Nobel was Utah. I thought there was another one there, but maybe that's Utah.
No, you're thinking of AMD.
No, I'm thinking of, not AMD, because it's, I just said it.
Yeah, Micron and then,
HP. HP's got stuff like
yes.
That.
Yes.
That's right. Scientists and engineers, as a share of the workforce, interesting that Colorado being number one, or Colorado being high, Washington, and states that you might expect being low. Patents. Now here, this is the Micron story. This is essentially a company that is very, very innovative, very big company in a small state. They also have a propensity to patent. So that's what you see there. Washington, perhaps not a big surprise. Boeing, Microsoft. I don't know if Starbucks does much patenting, but
every new drink is patented.
Don't laugh. Maybe it is.
The latte mocha grande. Industry investment R&D. This one I keep waiting for Michigan to go down. And they don't. They're still in the top group. They're number three. They've gone down a little bit. They used to be number one.
It's the denominator shrinks.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. You hit the nail right on the head, because I asked Scott about that, or my co-author Scott Andes, and said, "Yeah, the denominator shrinks." So probably the denominator shrinks faster. They're cutting production jobs maybe faster than the R&D. But you see Delaware with DuPont. Massachusetts.
Just use the UNS data. This probably predates the data come out from the state data.
Right.
When you get the new state data, it's different.
It will look different because the new NSF this is one we added last year, 2 years ago. This is essentially how much renewable energy growth and renewable energy and energy efficiency. Washington State, largely because of their hydro, Massachusetts, I think, and Maine because of some of their bio fuels, but interesting. Texas, not surprisingly, quite low on movement to the green economy. Oklahoma like to use oil. And finally, venture capital. A vast wasteland, actually.
It's a picture that never changes.
A picture that never changes. Massachusetts and California that take up two-thirds of the venture capital in the country. But having said that, even when you go back and look at the numbers of the board, there is still venture capital in all of these states. It's just that Massachusetts and California get so much of it. But venture capital does exist in these states. It exists in Virginia, and we don't think Virginia's even in the bottom. Okay. So the question is, why would you care about these? If you're a state policymaker, why would you even bother looking at the report? If you want jobs, and I hate to even say this in this climate, if you want jobs, this doesn't really matter very much. Sure. There's very little correlation between these measures and overall job growth. There is, however, a good correlation between per capita income growth, something in the area of 0.35. So these do seem to matter if you want to have growth of your incomes in a state, which I think, once we're out of the recession, that will go back to being the most important goal, I think, of economic policy. And the reason it doesn't matter for jobs is to take a state like Nevada, which from 2002 to 2006 was the fastest growing economy in the country in terms of jobs. And it ranked sort of 25th, 27th in terms of the state economy index. Didn't rank very well. Now, though, if you look at Nevada, it's from 2000 to 2006 was number one. From 2006 to 2008, it was number 25. So Nevada was essentially building an economy on a very weak foundation. Not really all that sustainable sort of growth for building your economy on the fact that you're just building your economy. Whereas you look at a state, like Washington State or Massachusetts, who I think have much more sound fundamentals that have done better. So what do we need to do? Two things. Usually these reports I have a lot of detailed policy recommendations. I didn't do that this year because I really wanted to make two main points. One is that when states started to do economic development in the 1940s, the 30s, the 40s, 50s, they were really doing this in the context of a national economy. Today it's a global economy. We as a nation are under the biggest challenge we faced ever in our history in terms of competitiveness. We really need to be basically saying we've got to reshape, states have got to reshape what locals do, states need to, and the Fed need to reshape what states do to be moving into what I would call win-win strategies. So there's one state, I won't say who it is because I don't want to embarrass them. They have a big industrial park in the state. It's a very nice asset. It's a really big, beautiful piece of property. What they do most of it is they recruit companies from other communities in the state to move there. Why do they do that? Because the people who are running the industrial park are rewarded on, are you full? They're not punished or penalized, or have you taken a job from another location in the town that's hurt their tax base? It's not even on the menu, not even on the agenda. So we really need to get states to be focusing on how do we, and localities, how do we create a bigger pie. I think one way to do that would be this federal government could really start to fund state innovation policies, but as a requirement for getting it, you've got to do less of this kind of zero-sum smokestack chasing. Doesn't mean you can't do incentives. Two issues ago, we wrote about a thing Texas did, which is, I still think, a great model. Texas Instruments was deciding where to locate a very large, multi-billion-dollar fab plant, and they were up for anywhere, they could put that anywhere in the world, certainly anywhere in the U.S., and all these states were coming in to give you, you know, checks and money and all this stuff, and Texas said, in a very enlightened moment, they said, no, what we're going to do is we're going to give $200 million to the University of Texas and really expand and improve the quality of our electrical engineering program. And that's what induced TI to build the factory, to build the plant there, because they were right next to this new knowledge factory, if you will, of this great engineering program. So it's not to say you can't do incentives or you shouldn't, but let's tie those incentives to kind of win-win. Second big issue is states have no money. And they're not going to have any money for 5 years, probably, then. So really states need to be thinking on focusing much more on what are the fundamentals. And a good example of that is there are states out there that give money to retail firms to recruit retail firms. Like, you know, if you know anything about economic base theory, you know, you don't really, if your barbershop industry is in crisis, you don't really have to worry because this is where Say's law is correct. Supply creates its own demand. If you have a demand for barbershops, I guarantee you someone will come up with another barbershop. Supply doesn't create its own demand for semiconductor factories, auto factories, anything like that. When an auto factory closes down, it's not like people go, you know what, I need a car. A car plant's going to emerge. So you really need to focus there. Embrace institutional innovation. This, to me, is one of the areas where the states really don't do a very good job. But states are engaged in all sorts of things, education, transportation. They really need to drive institutional innovation. A good example of that is what the Swedes are doing now in higher education. In Sweden and in Finland and a number of other countries, they're tying their higher education money. So you get less money if you don't work with industry and entrepreneurs and commercialize technology. If you do that, they give you a little more money. It's not a huge amount of differential. The delta's not big, but it's big enough to get their attention. And states need to be thinking more about that, leveraging other resources, whether it's federal, local, or private sector. And then lastly, we were having a conversation about this at lunch with, what's the guy at North Carolina
study? Ted Zoller.
Ted Zoller?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's done this really amazing study of looking and trying to understand entrepreneurial linkages and knowledge networks in communities. States can do a lot to build those knowledge networks. Those are really cheap. You know, you're not pouring, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to build a road or big tax breaks. These are small strategic steps to build these networks that can have big payoffs, but they tend to be under invested. So that's the overview of the study. Thank you, and Bob, interested to hear.
Okay. So look, I'm not going to do 10 or 12 minutes. I'm going to do 3 or 4 so you can get direct questions to Rob. I just want to give you a couple factoids. And first, probably start by answering an obvious question. Why do we support this fund? And the answer is, and the reason why people might ask the question is that we're a foundation of entrepreneurship, and it's not readily obvious why we would support somebody to rank states on innovation. But the answer to why we support this kind of work is that essentially what Rob has done is provide a lot of benchmarking of the preconditions for successful entrepreneurship, and in particular, high growth for which focus on entrepreneurship. And here's what I want to give you a couple factoids. First factoid, there are roughly 600,000 firms that are created every year in the United States. It's a number that is largely insensitive to cyclical fluctuation. It appears to be insensitive, because we only have 15 years of data, to changes in tax rates. All right. So I know why tax rates is a big issue in Washington right now, but nonetheless, the number of new firms does not appear to be sensitive to virtually anything. And my hypothesis for that, by the way, is that number is a mix of both what we call opportunity and necessity entrepreneurs. And so in good times, you get a lot of people who are opportunity entrepreneurs who get started because they see a lot of opportunities. But then when good times are good, the the necessity entrepreneurs, the people who don't have any other choice, they now have choices. They can go work for somebody else. So they go down. And then when you get bad times, like now, the necessity entrepreneurs go up because they can't find jobs. All right, but the opportunity entrepreneurs may be fewer because we've got a bad economy. And those two effects seem to offset each other, and that's why we don't see any cyclical pattern in the overall number. So that's the first factoid. The second factoid is that we've done a lot of studies that are on our internet site about the contributions of firms to growth. And we've done, and also John Halter and his colleagues at Maryland and also the Census Bureau have looked at job creation, not only by size, but by age of firm. And it turns out the size is not that important. There's all this hullabaloo about how small firms create more jobs. It turns out that is not the key statistic. It's the age of firm that matters. And it turns out that firms less than 5 years old between 1980 and 2005 created all net new jobs in the economy. So that means everybody over 5 years old, on balance, if you group them all and lump them together, the gainers offset the losers. And so all the dynamism in job creation is in new firms. That's second factor. Third factoid, which is about to come out in a study that I'm going to put out on our website in 3 weeks, I'm doing a study called Inventive $1 Billion Companies. And it's really another way of saying gazelles. And the study basically, it asks a hypothetical, but before I tell you the hypothetical, I'm basically saying it's not any new firm that counts, it's the really fast-growing firms that count, because those are the ones that are going to change our economy. So I asked the following hypothetical question. That's a variation on how many people does it take to screw up people. Okay? So my variation of that question is, how many billion-dollar firms would it take each year to be created to permanently raise the growth rate of the economy by 1%? And the reason I picked 1%, we picked it out of the air, but it's a kind of number which is easy. And it turns out if you do a compounding, it turns out that relative to not having that 1% growth, by 100 years later, your economy is three times richer on a per capita basis than an economy that grows at less than 1% less. So it turns out 1% growth really matters if accumulated over a long time. So then the question is, how do we get that 1% growth? And so I did a hypothetical by saying, let's just assume that it's all gazelles that do it. And I used a statistic that was developed by Bill Nordhaus at Yale in a landmark paper, in my opinion, several years ago, where he calculated what percentage of the gains from invention accrued to the inventor, all right, as opposed to society. Answer, 4% goes to the inventor. 96% goes to society. So think Bill Gates, all right? He gets rich. But the benefits of Bill Gates to the rest of the world are humongously greater than however rich Bill Gates is. Because if you think about what Microsoft did, is it made more efficient firms around the world, and it turns out Morehouse's number is 25-1. Now, he didn't look at just Bill Gates. He looked at a number of other inventions. But the idea is basically the same, is that what you want are firms whose social gains are much greater than their private gains. And so I use billion-dollar firms as a proxy for high social value firms. It's just a number, all right? And let's call those home run companies. All right, how many home runs do you have to have? And it turns out, before I give you the answer, that if you get doubles and triples, it reduces the number of home runs you need. All right, and we get lots of home runs and triples. Lots of triples and doubles. But I just hypothetically just ask, what if we had nobody? What if we had no singles, no doubles, and no triples, and all of our growth is going to be in home runs? How many home runs do we need to create a year? Answer, 60. Now, there's a range, and the paper will show how the range depends on the number of variables. So 60 a year. Now that doesn't mean that you need 60 companies each year to create $1 billion in sales. It means you need 60 companies each year that will eventually mature into $1 billion companies. Because my proxy for high social value companies is $1 billion in sales. Okay? So your next question ought to be, well, what's the baseline? How many $1 billion companies do we produce now? Well, we look back over the last 150 years and we've had some recessions, some wars, some depressions. And you do an average over the last 150 years, and the answer appears to be about 15. So this doesn't look so good. All right? If you want to permanently go and grow another 4%, 16 instead of 15, oh my God, it looks pretty terrible. We'll never get there. Well, that's the bad news. The good news is, as I said, we'll probably do a lot of doubles and triples, so we won't need 60. We may only need 30. That's point one. Point two is go back to that 600,000 number. 600,000 companies a year. So all I want out of 600,000, I need 30 or 60 of those to grow up to be the companies. This doesn't look so hard, all right? And really, what Rob has done in his report is sort of give sort of a roadmap to states of kinds of things that potentially they may be able to do to nurture and provide an environment where then we can generate these companies. So we know that education is really important. We know that broadband and several other things in your report. But he's basically saying these are the companies of the soil that are going to grow these 60 companies. And we at Kauffman, just to finish the commercial here, we at Kauffman have a new program we've been doing the last 2 years where we are trying to incubate within the company ourselves. So we're not just any incubator, not just like that incubator in that example that you gave. We don't just let anybody into our room. We screen the hell out of people. We use the American Idol concept where basically we audition. We audition lots and lots of people, and we get down to very few, and then we support a very few and put them into a network. And we hopefully are going to grow these companies that we're our second class now. Our first class were in medical devices and the life sciences. That's our first class. Our second class is going to be in education companies. Our next class, we're now debating about what we're going to do next. But the idea is we're going to do vertical by vertical, and we're going to try to nurture billion-dollar companies. And if we can somehow accidentally, quasi on purpose, stumble on the right formula and the magic sauce, then what we're doing can be replicated and should be replicated. And you don't get, it's not hard to get to 60. And that's what we want to do. And we think America can do this. And the final thing I'll let you know, just so you won't walk out of here too pessimistic, is that if you look at the current Fortune 500 today, half those companies started in either a recession or a bear market. So that should give you some comfort that we've done this work before and we can do it again. So I'll quit there.
Great. Thank you, Bob. That was great. When's the study coming out?
But they that should have come out probably this first or second week in December. It'll be on our website.
So, if you have questions or comments, Steve?
Bob, you talked about 1% GDP growth and its importance. Well, Rob Atkinson likes to say, it's a statistic I quote him on all the time, is that IT innovations that are deployed in the general economy improve productivity to the extent where you say they're responsible for 1 point of your GDP growth. You talked about that before, productivity improvements in the greater economy.
That might not. Just
the green light's on.
Green light's on. Yeah, I think it's on.
Yeah, green light's on.
Okay.
So, IT innovations that are then deployed in the greater economy is a key statistic and has been. And yet, this index doesn't seem to really capture that. I mean, figuring out how many IT, health companies do electronic pharmacy fulfillment. Doesn't really get to it. It's more like the Federal Express is deploying IT technology in a distribution business, or Netflix, or even Amazon. These are all companies and industries that won't count, but probably should count if we really are able to generate productivity growth and GDP growth by deploying IT in traditional industries. Do you feel like we capture enough of that in the index?
Let me start. I'm going to say the federal statistical system is abysmal. When you want to understand anything under the federal, I mean anything under the U.S. level. So we have looked since 1999, see, right at the very beginning, to get one measure, which was IT capital expenditure by state. Which is, you know, it's at the VA level. They've got software and IT equipment by the country. They break it down into subcategories, telecom and copy machines. They don't give it at the state level. And until they get it at the state level, we're going to use these proxy measures. So I don't disagree with you one iota. One of the biggest challenges doing a study like this, and it's 10 times harder to do it at the metro level, is data availability. And sort of one thing that I think the feds could do right away that would be easy would be to really just fund the statistical agencies better and have them also take a little bit more risk. I remember a few years ago we were trying to get some data from Census on manufacturing use of the internet and EDI and all sort of very interesting data. And I had to twist their arm to give it to them because they said the confidence intervals were too high. And I said, well, look, I can tell you right now that zero is a pretty, you know, I have nothing now. I'd much rather have something, and we will report that the confidence intervals are. They ended up giving it to me, but it was a real struggle. And I think they need to be a little bit less perfectionist in how they do this, because, you know, states are desperate for better data. and we don't really give them very much. Sam?
You have a comment and a question. The comment, Rob, is that I used to work for the Governors Association, and the idea that there should be a policy about smokestack chasing, which makes all the sense in the world, is one that the NGA has tried to grow for 20 or 30 years, and it never happens. You know, we can talk about why it never happens. Some of those reasons are obvious. So saying, well, the states should do this, it's in their interest, I don't think is really going to lead the states to reform, given the politics. But Bob, my question is this. Your gazelle theory, which I happen to, I worked with the Council on Competitiveness Week in the past, been big on clusters. But I think the gazelle theory is much more promising, and I'm curious about, do you contrast that with this great emphasis nowadays on clusters?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And in fact, Kauffman Labs is like the anti-cluster. All right, so look, I don't want to dispute the importance of clusters. I think they are, there's no question. Because clusters are local networks, and despite the internet, people matter, and connections matter, and this guy that Rob Atkins has talked about, Ted Zoller, who's done some remarkable research, shows that, indisputably, that people connect with them. But in the world of the internet and global communications, it turns out the clusters don't only have to be geographically limited. And so we're testing the theory of Kauffman. When we go into an industry vertical like education or medical device, we assemble a world-class network of people. They're all over the place. By the way, some of them may not be in the United States. And so when the entrepreneurs come in contact with that network, they get exposed to people all over the place. And then they are in continual contact through email and CV, et cetera. And so we are developing these virtual clusters to replace physical clusters. Not just to replace, to supplement physical clusters, because we will never, ever replace them. And they will always be important. But I think we now have a chance to add to them.
But if you were recommending an economic development strategy to places, why don't you tell them focus on clusters or focus on gazelles?
Well, I would focus on policies to basically, as I said to somebody, increase the odds that serendipity will strike. Because you can't plan for the creation of Microsoft or Dell or any other company. But through appropriate policies, through education, through making it easy as hell to get business licenses and so forth, you can increase the chances that some of these companies will start in your area. And so in that sense, I don't believe you can firmly create a cluster, but I think you can increase the odds of what will happen to you.
And you can support the ones that are there.
And the ones that are there, you can help them grow. Yes. So that, I definitely agree with.
Thanks, Rob. I love these when they come out. I'm wondering about, and also my home state of Arizona, I thought, why are they dropping these to do all this pursuit of innovation, but it actually is digital smokestacks. They would try to get California firms to come over, so maybe that's not the best way. Doing it in the quartile in state versus state has me wondering, though, you would want to encourage state policymakers to not only be proactive in this area, but stick with it over time, right? I'm thinking about Mississippi and Haley Barbour, and let's say they raise every single one of these categories, and they raise them at a really high rate, but they started out behind, and other states are raising maybe at a lower rate, but still, they could still be 50 or 49, right? I mean, so I could imagine then, you know, the policymakers said, well, that didn't work. So what do you do there?
That's a great question. You know, I guess the question is ultimately, are you better off sort of getting attention for these policies through fear, or does fear lead to paralysis? That's really what your question is, I guess. I remember just about 8 years ago, we released an earlier version, and I was at a conference, and a state senator from West Virginia came up to me and said, you know, I think they were 49 at the time, and they still didn't know. And I thought, okay, I'm getting the lecture. And instead he said, look, this has been a wake-up call. In fact, the even better story was Billy Tozan. Billy Tozan was a member of Congress. He read our report in Louisiana. It was like 48th or something like that. And he said, the State New Economy Index was a blow to my heart. And so he went back to Louisiana. And when you're to at the Commerce Committee, you can get whoever you want. He got all these CEOs to come down there, and he did a big summit, and he got the state to start to focus on this stuff. So I think at the end of the day, the fear is a bigger motivator, and I think even, I mean, it's amazing you go up there, and like a state will say, hey, we went up 5 slots. That's pretty good. So I don't, as long as you're showing some progress. And the other piece, too, is just standing still is declining in the global economy, so you have to keep moving. So I think ultimately it's probably better. So, probably have time for just two more.
So have you, now you have almost a decade of experience, and these are all outcomes. These are not policies, as you said. Can you look at states that have, can you tie the results to policies over time and see what has made a difference? That would be interesting. Right?
It would be interesting. Can you tie these to policies? And the answer is, if you had a good measure of policies, and that's just so hard to do, because you've got policies that are on how easy and transparent is the government process, how good is the educational system, how much money is the state putting in economic, how good is their infrastructure, do they have political corruption, all of these things. And it'd be great to do that. That's another, you probably could fund that next.
I don't get that much money.
Yeah, exactly.
But it would be interesting to look at. I haven't looked at this carefully right now, but some states have had a dramatic improvement. So you could do an in-depth, take two or three that went up a lot, went down a lot. Maybe you could find some.
No, I mean, you could do case studies. Yeah, exactly. And say, and
have your big movers.
Yeah, okay. Big movers. And to say, another way to do that too, to me, would be interesting is just to do that at the county or city level. Identify the top 100 counties or cities that have really grown in jobs and income, and is there something beyond serendipity or location or industrial mix that was something there? Those are very important questions, I agree. I think this is the last. Nope. Let's go, Mike, and then.
Just a quick, the jobs, okay? Very distressing, not a surprise, okay? How would you interpret that at this point? Because obviously, you're just going to say, get better, and then it doesn't have a job to go, it will say, someone.
You know,
and
I mean,
sure, the measure level.
I agree, and the nice, if we had the time and the variables, we would have done a regression analysis. Because what has happened, part of what's going on here is if you look at the high scoring states, they tend to be in that, New Jersey up. Well, those states, for, whether it goes back to the old snow belt theories or whatever. Those are not fast-growing states, and so even if you have dynamic economies, they're just not going to grow that fast because people aren't moving there. People are, moving out to North Carolina, other places, Colorado, and so on. And so, I having no data to back my next statement up, I will say I do think that at the end of the day, these policies are associated with jobs. It's these structures. Is that the people who have the best structures tend to be in regions of the country that just aren't growing as fast. And so if you could control for that, I do think you'd see a jobs impact.
But there's still nothing wrong, Michael, in being able to say this is a living standard of things.
No, there's nothing wrong, and I certainly believe that these are good things. It's just that this particular fact slows one down.
Especially this year. Yeah.
Especially this year.
I agree. But one of the things that we've done all along is to try to use this to convince policymakers. Again, go back to my favorite whipping boy, Nevada. Nevada, whatever the major newspaper in La Vegas, called me up one time. We'd like you to comment on a thing, the policy the state is doing there. Recruiting a major company to come to Nevada is going to create 350 jobs and giving them, X gazillion dollars. And I said, well, what's the average wage? And they said, $9 or something like that as well. So they're now subsidizing an intentional decline of their per capita income. That's the policy.
That's not a good thing.
You don't want to be giving money to make yourself poor. Right. And I think just having the states focus more, at least rebalancing it so they think a little bit about where you're going, not just the number of jobs. I want to think about job quality.
Yeah.
And family wage incomes for people. And that's, a, I think, a useful anecdote to a lot of their just kind of mindless more jobs, kind of chamber of commerce, you know. More jobs are better all the time. Now, clearly in a recession and downturn in states like Michigan, even before that, more jobs is better. But
you high, just, high-paid jobs are even better.
Yeah, high-paid jobs are even better. Exactly. So, I think we have now got to go do a call with some reporters, and so I really appreciate everybody coming, and feel free to follow up with emails wherever you have questions.